This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. President Trump's executive order temporarily banning travel to the U.S. by people from seven Muslim-majority countries and stopping refugee resettlement here is in the courts. Meanwhile, there's a lot of confusion and anxiety about what this may ultimately mean. Later in the program, we hear from some folks who deal with the refugees who have already arrived in our city and more are coming. Who are they? Where did they come from? How did they end up here, and who is helping them to acclimate? First, though, Mayor Jennifer Roberts. She spent some time this week giving her State of the City address, and we've invited her to share some of that information and more in the first part of the program. Mayor Roberts, welcome back.
Good to be here, Mike.
In your address on Monday, you portrayed Charlotte as being on the offensive. So who's playing defense?
So we are focusing on the strengths of our city, and we are focusing on how we can continue to grow opportunity in every corner of the city, how we can continue to attract business, and how we can continue to be a 21st century city, focusing on technological innovation, creativity, and attracting talent.
Is this what you would be doing at this point in your tenure as mayor and the tenure of the city council had it not been for HB2, or would you be focused on different goals?
Well, we're always focused on being the best city we can be and attracting talent and growing business. I think that we have had challenges because of HB2. Although, because Charlotte stood up for equality and inclusion at the beginning of this conversation, people around the country and the world know that Charlotte is a 21st century city that recognizes talent comes in all shapes and sizes. And we've had some success even in some conventions and companies who are hesitant because of what the state action brought to our state. They have had, they recognize that Charlotte is different and that Charlotte has those values. So we've been successful in continuing to grow. We're the second fastest growing city in America.
But we're still being punished in some ways. Does that puzzle you why the NBA withdrew, for instance, the All-Star game from Charlotte? You, in your mind, tried to do the right thing, and yet they said, well, the state doesn't want you to do the right thing, so we're not coming. Is that fair?
Well, you have to remember there are a lot of people who have input into the decision-making of organizations like the NBA, the NCAA, and there are a lot of gay fans, players, sponsors that care about equality and inclusion, and they have to balance the concerns and the perspective of all those folks when they're talking about a major event.
How much money has the city of Charlotte lost? Can you put a dollar figure on it? Because there are people in the legislature who say it's immaterial.
Well, we know it's
consequential.
We know, at least from estimates that the Regional Visitors Authority has put forward, that it is over $300 million. If you add up all the events, jobs from companies that didn't come here. We also know that there are some companies that would look to expand that just took Charlotte off the list, or North Carolina off the list, even before we knew about it. So we know it's higher than that. And if you think about the people impacted, especially with events, you know, a lot of small business owners, a lot of folks who are hourly workers in our hotels and restaurants. So it's been very hard for them.
And despite all of this, both sides have dug in their heels on this issue. So looking back, do you regret taking us down this path?
Well, I need to remind you that we actually worked with the legislature to come to an agreement, repeal. We did our part. We have shown that we are willing to work with the legislature. We did everything they asked us to do. They didn't do what they agreed to do.
But
so
that doesn't answer my heels. That doesn't answer my question. Do you regret taking us down this path?
Charlotte stood up for the equal rights of every single citizen. Charlotte will continue to stand up for the equal rights of every single citizen. It's not special rights. It's just equal. And we continue to believe the city council voted the citizens of Charlotte in, you know, over a year of having conversations about, you know, different campaigns and standing up for equality. The people of Charlotte supported that. And it is the right thing to do in the 21st century to say that discrimination is not right.
Let me go back to the fact that it appeared as though the city and the legislature had reached an agreement, and there was going to be a promised repeal, and then it didn't happen. And we've had discussions on this program about this. We've had several of the players involved at the legislature and in this area on the show. We haven't talked to you about this, however. What happened in your mind? And many in the legislature looked at the fact that the city didn't repeal all of the ordinance initially as bad faith, even though the city, I think, says we thought we were doing everything they wanted. We repealed the parts of this that were immediately applicable to HB2 and then immediately came back and repealed all of it. So what really happened in your mind?
Well, I will let folks know that we were in direct conversation with both Phil Berger and Tim Moore's offices every step of the way. And so our first vote, when we repealed those sections that HB2 had preempted, we were doing exactly what those leadership offices told us to do. And when it came back the next day that there was some concern because it wasn't a repeal of that one little piece of the contracting portion, we called an emergency session and said, okay, full repeal, no conditions, no expiration. There was, complete and full repeal just to make sure that no one could use that as an excuse. So we did everything and more that was preempted by HB2 that was asked of us by the legislature. And so I don't know why they were unable to fulfill their part of the agreement, because that was full repeal.
So let me ask you what I have asked legislators about Charlotte and what I've asked other Charlottians about the legislature. Do you feel double-crossed?
I think they are playing politics, and I don't believe in backroom deals, right? We have been transparent. We went to Raleigh for our retreat and had 16 out of 17 of our local legislators come to dinner with us for 3 hours to build that relationship, have those conversations. We also took folks over to meet people at the legislature. We are working very hard to be transparent, to be in direct contact. And so it's very interesting to see how they continue to play politics.
The NCAA is just days away from deciding where they will play their championship games over the next 6 years. And if HB2 is still in effect, we will not have those games for at least 6 years. Given that, and given that this is such a basketball, college sports-crazed state, do you know of any movement in the legislature toward repealing this just for the NCAA tournaments?
Well, I think that there are a lot of pressures on the legislature right now. And I know that there are ongoing conversations because I have been in touch with legislators and with the governor's office. And we know that they are continuing to try to figure out how to get the votes and what comes next. Because it's really about more than just a full repeal. It's about what happens after that. We have said, and other cities have said, you have got to let us protect our own citizens. You have got to give us some way that we can say discrimination against the LGBT community is not right. And I think the conversation is about what does that look like.
And we're talking about the potential loss of $250 million. I'm a little unclear about whether that's over the course of 6 years, if we lose these games for 6 years, or whether it's $250 million a year. I'm not clear about that. But in the face of the loss of so much revenue, do you understand how the legislature can ignore this? I mean, what is the crux of this? What is the bottom line here?
Well, I tell you, the challenge is that we have a legislature controlled by rural interests, and our rural areas have different needs than our cities. Because of gerrymandering.
But the city always needs money.
Because of gerrymandering, those folks have a disproportionate power in the legislature. It does not reflect. You just look at the congressional folks. You know, we had a 6-7 split Democrat-Republican before redistricting. Now we have 10-3. So it doesn't reflect really the people of North Carolina. And I think that that's why the pressure is not being felt by these rural legislators, because they're not connected to the cities where this is a real challenge.
Charlotte had the Obama administration's Justice Department on its side. Where does the Trump administration's Justice Department stand on this issue, or do you know?
Well, clearly there's a lot of confusion right now with where the Trump administration stands on quite a few things. And we are working very hard through our senators and congressional representatives to try to have a voice with that new administration. But we're waiting to see where things will fall out.
At one point, you said that you were most proud of standing strong, and you've said this morning, most proud of standing strong for equality, that every person was worthy of dignity and respect. But you've also said that the legislators in Raleigh need to let Charlotte be Charlotte. We are the economic engine of the state. All of that is true, at least the second part of that is true. Clearly, they don't care. Clearly, that they continue to see us as the great state of Mecklenburg. They are tired of that, and they resent it. So, in this reality of politics in which we live, this great urban-rural divide, do you think anything is gained by reminding the legislature that Charlotte should be Charlotte and that we are the economic engine of the state? Or is that just putting salt into the wound?
Well, I think we need to speak the truth. And I have always been a transparent advocate. I have always been open to input from many different sides. Just last night, I was at a regional meeting where we had mayors and council members and commissioners from all across our 9-county region. Charlotte shows up. Charlotte is part of the region. We're part of the state. We connect to our rural areas. We've had a connection with the farms around Mecklenburg and the Farm to Fork movement. We are trying in every way we can to show that our economies are interdependent. Mm-hmm. And that's what we want to do. I've talked to, we have about 30 metro mayors who have a conference call every month, and we talk about the fact that we are all connected to our rural centers, that we are interdependent, and we're going to continue to show that those economies work together. We work best when we work together, and that's what we want to convey to our legislature. It's not just my voice. It's voices of leaders around the state who are sending the same message.
So when officials give the State of the Union address, when the president gives the State of the Union, when governors give the State of the State, and I guess you've just given the State of the City address, they always tell us the State of the Union is, the State of the State is, the State of the City is, fill in the blank. So fill in the blank.
So what I said is the future of our city is limitless. And what I meant by that is that we are looking to the future. We are looking to prepare our young people for anything that might come. We are working hard in the mayor's office, with the city, with the chamber, a lot of folks, to strengthen apprenticeships and internships for young people. One of the things that we found in the opportunity gap is that our unemployment rate for young people is higher than it should be. And so we want to bring opportunity to them and make sure that they understand, with technology and with the training that we're going to continue to build, their future is limitless. And that's what I said about our city, because our city continues to attract millennials. Half the folks moving here are under age 35. So we want to be that city of opportunity.
And as they come, they are renting these ever-increasingly expensive apartments that are being built all over town, and that's raised the question of affordable housing. And when you combine that with the fact that Charlotte ranks almost dead last in upward mobility. If you're born poor here, chances are you're going to die poor here if you stay in Charlotte. How do you fix that? How do you address that while you're trying to attract newcomers who are raising the prices of things?
Well, it's a both and. You have to continue to work with the community that you have. You have to continue to work with the partnerships that you have, but also work with new companies and new ideas and new energy coming here. We have to build our talent here. We have to make sure that the challenge areas of our city get the opportunity as well, and work with the new ones.
Mayor Jennifer Roberts, our guest in this part of the program. When we come back, we'll talk about the prospect of Major League Soccer and why the city said no, and more on immigration. Stay with us. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Corkscrew Wine Shop and Bar. New location now open at The View in downtown Charlotte near BB&T Ballpark. Full portfolio of wine and beer from all over the world, plus live music. Details at thescrewcrew.com. And Blumenthal Performing Arts presenting Blumenthal Celebrates Dance featuring Twyla Tharp Dance. The evening promotes healthy living with activities, lectures, and performances. February 25th at Belk Theater. Tickets available at 704-372-1000. Tomorrow on the local news roundup, North Carolina joins the growing legal opposition to President Trump's executive action on immigrants and refugees. The clock is ticking on more sports losses tied to HB2. A 3-judge panel temporarily halts confirmation hearings for Governor Governor Cooper's cabinet nominees, and Tar Heel senators say yes to Betsy DeVos as education secretary. We're going to have those stories, details on those stories and more with our roundtable of reporters tomorrow on this program at 9.
I'm Tom Asbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, former U.S. Ambassador to Moscow, Michael McFaul, warns Americans not to let their leaders go down the path of Vladimir Putin. He joins us. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
Join On Point this morning from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte Talks, on listener-funded public radio 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. A little later on in the program, we're going to meet folks who deal with immigrants and refugees coming to Charlotte. We'll talk to them in just a moment. But right now, we're talking to Mayor Jennifer Roberts, who this week gave her State of the City address. The city recently did something that many say it has never done. It said no to participating in a public-private partnership with Marcus Smith for Major League Soccer. The county said yes. This is the same city that had a referendum on whether or not we should build the arena for basketball downtown. Voters said no. The city said, well, we're going to do it anyway. So what happened? Why you never say no. Why did you say no?
Well, I think that we're listening very carefully. But, you know, there are a lot of reasons. I mean, first of all, I want to say that soccer is a great sport. It would be great to have expansion in that area. And, you know, we're continuing to have conversations about a future bid that the city might be part of. But this was not the right deal at the right time. It was very rushed. We did not have time for complete public input. And I could not, in all conscience, support a deal that was literally redirecting money that might be going to education. That looking at, again, the Opportunity Task Force, as you said, rising rents, the need for affordable housing, the priorities the city has for workforce, all the things that we know that the disparities that exist in our economic opportunity and our racial disparities, all those things that have been priorities for the city, we could not support. And it wasn't just me. We had a conversation with the city council, and the majority of council members felt the same way, that we just could not support this deal at this time.
Let's go back, because you just said that we have other needs, money for education being one of them. The money for this was coming from the motel tax on the city's part of this. Where does that money go right now? Does it go to education?
So, no. The city's part of that money goes to tourism and entertainment venues. So we have our
stadium. So how could this be taking money away from education?
The deal as a whole. And remember, because
you mean the county's
part? The county's portion. Remember, our citizens look at the deal as a whole. And the city would be supporting what the county was doing as well. And that is something that, again, we heard from constituents.
Right.
Who said, we know that your tourism dollars, and by the way, we have other needs coming up, the convention center, the arena, the stadium, Discovery Place, which is also education, and that's directly connected to our tourism dollars. You know, so many of our kids go through there. But we had constituents say, you know, this is just not in keeping with our priorities right now, especially when we've seen the challenges our community has in the disparities that we know continue. So, listening to all that, having the rush and not a lot of unanswered questions about infrastructure, about so many of the things that the stadium would bring, the location, other sites being vetted, et cetera, we couldn't support going forward at this time.
We're watching the art of the deal unfold in Washington in many ways. So is this just the first shot in an ongoing negotiation? Is the fact that the city, which never says no or has the reputation of the perception of never saying no, says no, is that the opening shot of trying to get a better deal? You want soccer here, but you want more time and you want maybe a different level of participation. Is that what this is about?
Well, I think that all those things, you know, we're open to discussion, and we've said that. We're not slamming the door because we are a great city for sports events. We have a growing fan base, a lot of kids involved in soccer, and we know that it's not just two teams that will be added, it's four. So down the road, when the next bid comes around, you know, we've got time to really talk about what kind of structure we would support.
How are you going to feel if Raleigh gets it and we don't?
Well, we'll have to see. Certainly, you know, Raleigh's a great city in North Carolina. They've got the Hurricanes. We've got the Panthers. But we would,
not
we would
an equivalency.
Like to no, not anywhere near. But we will we like to compete.
So
we'll put it that way.
So the city council and you have not ruled out the possibility of joining into some sort of a soccer agreement with Marcus Smith and with the county as well. In your mind, what would that deal look like?
Well, remember, it's not my mind. It is the council. We have 11 members. We have a city manager.
A collective your. What would it look like, the deal?
Well, we want to see, first of all, I mean, there's so many issues. The site, the location, how many locations were vetted? There are a lot of folks that are in that neighborhood. Central Piedmont Community College totally locks in that site. It's near a residential neighborhood. We haven't heard input on traffic study or any of that impact. So I think the site is an issue. We had a lot of interest in Eastland because it's a place that could be redeveloped and bring a lot of attraction. You know, what would it take to have that be a valid location? We haven't heard answers to a lot of those things. So the site is an issue. The mix of private and public money. When you look at other stadiums around the country, the private partners have put in more money. If you look at how we did baseball, the city and the county paid for infrastructure, but they didn't pay for the stadium. You know, is that the kind of model we want to look at? You know, I think that those are aspects of it. And we want to look at usage going forward. Again, where are the redevelopment sites? We want to see that it brings, you know, economic development nearby. We were told there were 60 acres. I've never seen a map of where those 60 acres are. Again, that's related to the site. Are there other places that would spur more economic development? We want to bring jobs as well as, you know, visitors and sports enthusiasts.
Final question on this. We've lost the NBA All-Star game. We've lost some playoff games. We may lose 6 years worth of NCAA games, all because of HB2. And it's likely that HB2 may be around for a while, given the political climate in the legislature. So wouldn't soccer, which would be financed by the city end of this through the hotel motel tax, wouldn't that help make up some of the lost revenues, particularly to people in the hotel motel industry, if we had soccer here?
Well, you bring up another point that we haven't seen information on. We haven't seen an economic impact study. You know, what has soccer done in other parts of the country? How many successful teams are there? You know, certainly it's very successful in Europe. You know, what stage is that in the United States? We haven't seen that information. So I don't know the answer to that, and that's something that we'll be asking going forward.
Of course, the big news, one of the big stories out of Washington, there's so many big stories out of Washington, it's hard to keep track of them these days, but one of the big stories is about the immigration and refugee ban, which we're going to spend the rest of the program talking about with other guests. But without naming the president, you said in your State of the City speech that Charlotte will oppose any moves that run counter to the city's values, that welcome people from across the country and around the world. Do you think that Charlotte, do you think of Charlotte, you think that Charlotte is a sanctuary city?
Charlotte has never described itself as a sanctuary city. And we have not said that we're going to ignore deportation orders. In fact, the state passed a law prohibiting sanctuary cities in North Carolina. And we are complying with state and federal law. So we want to be a welcoming city. Within state and federal law, we want to make sure that our immigrants who are here feel welcome. We had a whole immigrant integration task force so we can support immigrant businesses, so we can support helping legal residents become citizens. We have a lot of citizenship classes. We are supporting integrating immigrants who are here and refugees who are here. Mm-hmm. We want to be welcoming. We don't want to discriminate. We want to help them have access to all the services that are here.
Mecklenburg County Commissioner Bill James wants the Justice Department, the U.S. Justice Department, to look into whether the city is complying with Donald Trump's executive order, which targets sanctuary cities that refuse to cooperate with the federal government. He worries that CMPD, which has a policy of not asking people about their immigration status, could jeopardize federal funds for the city and the county. Have any comment on that?
Certainly. We are complying with state and federal law. Our attorney has confirmed that. We had a whole, I think, an hour-long presentation at our last city council meeting to confirm that. And public safety is a two-way street. We know that we have to have trust between the police and the community they serve. And if we have police who are acting as federal agents and going in, you know, proactively saying, what's your immigration status? That makes it less safe for everyone. And that is not what the federal order says. Our local police are trained in local law. That's what they're going to continue to do. They want citizens to trust them, to be able to call them when there's a crime, and to be witnesses for crimes.
CMPD is not alone in being a police department that doesn't necessarily ask your immigration status when you're pulled over for a traffic violation. Other cities do the same thing or don't do the same thing. They just don't ask. But where does the policy come from? Is it within CMPD, or does it come? Was it handed down to them by the city or the county?
Well, the state law says that a city cannot prohibit the police officers from asking immigration status, but it does not say that they have to. Again, for public safety, for people, both our officers and our community to be safe, they have to trust that the police are there. If they're victims, if they're witnesses to a crime, we've got to be able to solve those crimes and keep the criminals off the street. And if they are being federal agents, which they're not trained to be, then that safety, that sense of trust will be eroded. And so they are complying with what the federal law requires, but also their protocol is to, you know, public safety is the first requirement, and they've got to work with the community to do that.
You just mentioned some ways that the city's been working with local leaders to build and preserve trust, and you've talked about building and preserving trust in all of our communities, including immigrant communities. How is the trust building business going in the Black community?
We have a number of initiatives that our police department is continuing to pursue. We are following the 21st century policing guidelines of the Obama administration, working through those, showing the community that we're doing that. We have the Police Foundation, who's doing a review of policies and procedures. We have a number of transparency workshops. We have cops and barbers. We have cops and kids, cops and clergy. Our police officers are putting in overtime and spending time in the communities, just being people, bringing their families, interacting with folks, helping people understand that public safety is a two-way street, that this trust in the community needs to be built. And we still have some work to do. We're putting our officers, as well as our city staff and leadership, through training such as dismantling racism, which shows that we have systems that have grown out of a racist past. We're also working on implicit bias training. It is a heavy lift, but we are working through it with the goal of everyone being safer.
I know I only have a minute left with you because you have to leave, but that's okay. But you talked about opposing any moves that run counter to the city's values of welcoming people from around the country and around the world. How do you do that if this immigration ban stands? If the court says, go ahead, Mr. President, how do you do that in the face of federal power?
Well, the immigration ban is something that is for people entering our country. That's, again, federal control, and the city can't really can't impact that except through advocacy. And again, with our communities here, certainly we have a voice. We have a voice with our state legislators, with our federal legislators, with the White House. I've joined with other mayors around the country to talk about our country continuing to welcome immigrants and welcome refugees to be a place of opportunity in the right way. Again, we know that talent comes in all shapes and sizes. So it's being that voice, joining with others around the country who recognize that America is a place that does not discriminate against people based on religion or national origin. And we want to continue to be that shining city on a hill.
And you mentioned we're a nation of immigrants, and together we will continue to lift the lamp beside the golden door. Sitting on a hill, golden doors, it's everywhere. Mayor Roberts, thank you for joining us. I appreciate your time.
Always good to be here, Mike. I'll see you soon.
Well, first came President Trump's executive order banning travel to the United States from seven majority Muslim countries and putting a temporary stoppage on refugees from coming in. That caused chaos at airports around the world for a weekend. A court quickly stepped in with a stay of that order, but the administration spent part of Tuesday defending the ban before the court. We're still awaiting the court's decision. Whichever way it goes, it is likely the losing side will appeal. All of this has struck fear and uncertainty into the hearts and lives of immigrants and refugees already in this country, including those here in Charlotte. And we're going to spend the rest of the hour talking about them. Who are these people? Where did they come from? How did Charlotte become home? How are they acclimating, and who's helping them to do so? We're joined by Marcia Hirsch, Executive Director of the Carolina Refugee Resettlement Agency here in Charlotte. Welcome to the program. Good morning.
Good morning.
And Takur Mishra is a case manager with that agency who came to America as a refugee from Bhutan in 2009. He has since become a U.S. citizen. Good morning to you. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Start by telling us a little bit about the Carolina Refugee Resettlement Agency. I'm not sure many people know about this. So when did the need for such a body arise?
Well, refugees have been being resettled into the Charlotte area since the early 1980s, first through Catholic Charities. And then in the mid-90s, people from the former Soviet Union were also being brought to Charlotte. And so the founder of Carolina Refugee began as a volunteer assisting former Soviet Jews to have their new lives here in Charlotte.
And how many people would you characterize as being refugees? How many refugees do we have in our midst?
Well, that's a good question. With almost 30 years of resettlement into the city and the fact that Charlotte is a very thriving and affordable place to live, people are coming into the city from other parts of the country that may have been former refugees and now live here. So there are thousands and thousands of people from former Soviet Union, from Vietnam, from Bosnia, from Bhutan, from Burma, more recently people from Iraq and Afghanistan and Syria. So anywhere where there's been strife in the world and people have had to flee for their lives, they may eventually wind up coming to the United States for resettlement.
Most people don't think about refugees very much. And when we do think about them, we think about them being over there. Only recently have we begun to think about them as coming here. And many times, and I think it's the case with Takur Mishra, refugees don't have a choice in terms of where they go, in terms of what country or even what city they go to. Is that correct?
That's correct. Refugees usually do not have any choice. So when they are offered the option of third country resettlement, they won't be offered where they will be resettled, first thing. Like in my own example, I was not told until the last minute that I would be resettled in the Bronx in New York City. But then I knew from the day one when I processed the application that I would be brought to the United States.
Okay. So how does it work from our point of view? Do we reach out? Do we tell the government or the national, international resettlement agencies that we are willing to take X number of people here in Charlotte? Or do they come to you and say, we need to settle X number of people in your city? How does it work? 30 seconds.
First of all, it has to be understood that the refugee resettlement process actually begins overseas with the United Nations. So the UN is operating under the Geneva Convention, and so when people are brought to the United States, it's through that mechanism with the United Nations.
I'll get more of an answer in just a moment. We have to take a break. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Donald Hack Diamonds, hosting a Philip Gavriel trunk show in celebration of Valentine's Day, Thursday and Friday, 10 a.m. till 6 p.m., Saturday, 10 a.m. till 4, featuring chocolate and wine pairings. Details at DonaldHack.com. And from Bradley, a full-service law firm featuring or serving the construction industry in Charlotte and throughout the nation, partnering with clients for all their legal needs. Details at Bradley.com. Politico.com. President Trump continues to raise eyebrows with his comments about Russia and President Vladimir Putin, most recently this week when Trump said he respects the Russian leader. Former U.S. Ambassador to Russia Michael McFaul, who served in that post in the Obama administration, is among those wary of Trump's attitude toward Russia, and he will join Tom Ashbrook during On Point's 100-day spotlight, which continues on this station in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock. And we're coming right back.
It's the new administration's first 100 days, and the news is coming fast.
Protesters arrived here.
Keystone XL pipeline.
The Affordable Care Act.
New refugee Obamacare. Admissions for 100.
All things considered, we'll be here to help you make sense of it all. Listen every day.
Hear the latest news from NPR, plus WFAE news updates from the Charlotte region, weekdays from 4 to 6:30 p.m. on WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about immigration and refugees, particularly those in Charlotte, with Marcia Hirsch, Executive Director of the Carolina Refugee Resettlement Agency, and Takor Mishra, who is a case manager for that organization and an immigrant from Bhutan. He came here in 2009, came to the United States in 2009. We'll hear his story in just a couple of seconds to give you an idea of what refugees really go through when they finally arrive here and before they finally arrive here. So I asked how it happens, and I didn't give you enough time to answer. In other words, do we reach out and say we can accept X number of people? So if you're looking to resettle folks, international agency, you can put them here? Or do they target you and say we need you to take these people?
It's a combination, actually. Okay. So there are currently over 15 million people in the United Nations database, meaning that they have registered as refugees with the UN.
How many?
Over 15 million.
Where are they?
They are all over the world.
Are they all in refugee camps? Are they people living in the shadows of their own country trying to get out? Where are they?
No. In order to have refugee status with the United Nations, you have to have fled from your home country to a second and found your way to a UN facility. In some parts of the world, yes, that is a camp, the type of situation that you might see in the media or on the news. But there are oftentimes people that are just going to a UN office and registering and then living in a country where there has been no camp set up.
So when the president's immigration ban went into effect, and it's been stayed by a court, but when it came down, you were working with 37 people whose arrival was imminent.
Yes.
And expected. Where are those people now? What has happened to them?
Well, some of those people wound up coming in this week because of the stay with the Washington court. Other people are currently in transit because of the stay with the Washington court. And then there'll be some people that will have to wait and see beyond February 17th whether their travel will be rebooked or not.
And are any of the people coming in, the 37 people that you were working with just prior to the ban, any of them from the seven countries mentioned in the ban, the seven majority Muslim countries mentioned in the ban?
Yes. We have had arrivals from Syria and from Iraq. But we will also be receiving people from Bhutan this week as well.
Even if the ban is upheld by the court and it goes into effect, it calls for a suspension for 120 days, I think, for refugees. To a lot of people, that sounds reasonable, isn't it?
Well, the problem is that the vetting process has multiple layers of clearances, security, medical, and background checks. And all of those clearances are in an expiration period. So if you've got someone who's slated for travel in the next 30 days, then the probability that some aspect of their clearance will expire during the next 120 days will put them unable to travel. They will not be allowed to enter the country, and they will have to begin the process all over
again.
And
that process can take how long?
18 months to 2 years.
You told WBTV that you have never had a security concern with any of the refugees resettled here. Why? Are you just being naive about those people, or were you just merely trusting the vetting process?
Well, we receive all of these individual people right off the plane. They're coming into our offices. They're being involved in core services required by the State Department. They are met with our staff to begin obtaining jobs. Their children are enrolled into the public school system. And so we are living and working among the people that come off the plane for weeks and months at a time. As it goes, oftentimes people that were our refugee clients for Carolina Refugee Resettlement Agency over time often become our friends. And so with that, there's no people that I've ever interacted with at CRA that have ever given me cause for concern as a circumstance of national security.
CRRA is Carolina Refugee Resettlement Agency. Marsha Hurst is the executive director and one of the case managers there. Takur Mishra is with us, and he is from Bhutan, which is on the eastern edge of the Himalayas, bordered by China to the north and India to the south. And you told WCNC-TV that you were heartbroken by the president's executive order. Is that because you know what it's like to be on the other side of the wall?
I mean, when the executive order was signed, it came to me as so personal, because only 7.5 years ago, I mean, this country had an open arm to welcome me and 1,000 others. And then within a time span of just 7.5 years of me being in this country for a second hope and a second home, you know, and the new administration slamming doors on people like me who would have gotten a second hope if we had let that door open. I mean, it was so personal to me. And then I felt heartful. It was frustrated. And it's scary at some point, too.
You came here in 2009. You point out that you came from a place that considers itself, and I quote here, the happiest country on the planet, Bhutan. In fact, it measures the well-being of its citizens in gross national happiness. That only counts if you're not Hindu, I take it. Is that right?
Eventually, it appears that the regime's aim was to wipe out at least one of the ethnic groups from the country, and then would call the country as a gross national happiness.
So although you arrived here in 2009, this to me is amazing. You spent 20 years in a refugee camp in a 200-square-foot house with 10 people, no electricity, no indoor running water, no privacy, no security, nothing. The closest that most of us get to anything like that is watching it on wide shots on the evening news, refugee camps in UN places. Can you describe for us what living in those conditions for 20 years was like? What did that do to you?
I mean, I became a refugee only when I was 7 years old and had to spend all my youthful life in the refugee camp, trying to figure out what would happen next. There were no hopes there. You could dream anything big or small, but then you are again living in a constrained place where you don't have any kind of opportunities, whether you want to pursue a higher education or whether you want to go take a better job somewhere else.
So how quickly could you adapt to life here after 20 years? You were there, you went into that camp when you were 7 years old. So after 20 years, you suddenly find yourself in the United States, in the Bronx, of all places. How do you adapt to that?
It was extremely difficult initially. But then the way that I was being helped by the local resettlement agency in the New York City gave me some new hopes. And I had a feeling in my mind that living in the United States was way, way, way better than living in the refugee camp.
Has it proven to be the case?
Yes.
although you arrived here in 2009, the vetting process began 2 years prior to that in 2007, because they offered you resettlement in 2007, but it took 2 years to go through the process. What is that process like for you? What kinds of things do you have to do? What hoops do you jump through?
At some point, I mean, even when I waited for 2 years, I was frustrated, because there are several layers of interviews, screenings, biometrics, and if
what are biometrics for people who don't know, including me?
Okay, they would be the U.S. government officials will be taking the biometrics.
What are they? What are biometrics?
I think they
fingerprints, eye scans.
Fingerprints, and then I think eye scans too.
All right, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
So there are several layers of interview, several layers of screening, medical screening, security clearance. They would look for any and all information that would be deemed ineligible for making these people not come to the country.
They would be looking for
anything that they would find as a red flag.
Did you know people who were rejected?
I knew a lot of people back then, and I still know a lot of people being rejected. We are still living in the refugee camp.
And give me an example of why they might have been rejected.
So one of my neighbors had to spend a life in prison for 2 years for an alleged murder, but then he was released later from the prison after 2 years. But the U.S. government said, no, we cannot take you to our country.
So this process goes on for 2 years. How often do you meet with officials during this process?
It could be somewhere from within a month to constantly waiting to be called for interviews or any kind of screening.
And are you under surveillance? When you're not in the office talking to people and being questioned by people, are you under surveillance? Are you even aware of that? Do you know that?
I think we will be under some kind of surveillance, yes.
What do you know about that, Marsha, about the process? I'm trying to get to it because people don't trust the vetting process.
Well, from the standpoint that the refugee resettlement process has been going on for almost 30 years, and the groups, particularly the ones that were mentioned in the executive order as groups of concern, the extensiveness of the vetting procedures have been increased and increased and increased over the years. So I guess the question will be for the future, what is expected for the vetting process to look like in order for it to be satisfactory?
Where were you between the time you were 7 years old and had to leave Bhutan because your father was being persecuted because he was Hindu and they were trying to do an ethnic purge? Where did you go? Where did you spend that 20 years?
So we walked barefoot for 3 days and spent a day riding in a truck and reached a refugee camp in Nepal, only about 300 miles away from where we were born.
Okay. So you spent 20 years in Nepal in a refugee camp, and then suddenly in 2009 you're on an airplane headed to the Bronx. One of the things that we are told that the United States does particularly well is to help people from other parts of the world assimilate. They don't do so well in France or some of the European cities, but they're not immigrant cultures. We are an immigrant culture. You went to the Bronx first. I think then you went to California. Is that right?
No, I went to Raleigh.
Raleigh. And then you finally came here, and you help now other people like yourself assimilate to this culture. How difficult was it, and what are the challenges faced by the people you work with today as they come to Charlotte in terms of making this home?
I mean, I came to the Bronx with some English, and then I did not have that language problem. And I now work with refugee populations who come to Charlotte with limited or sometimes with no English. I mean, that could be – language could be one barrier that they might have. And when I compare their story with mine, mm-hmm. I mean, I always feel like I might have lived a luxury life than the refugees who have come from other parts of the world, because they have suffered a lot, and beyond any imagination.
You say that the U.S. is known as the beacon of hope and a protector of human rights around the world, in other countries, in refugee camps. This is where people want to come. But do you understand the fear and that a lot of people feel and the need to protect our borders that the president feels that has led us to this point? Do you understand that?
Yes, I understand that.
Do you think it's justified, or are we overreacting?
I mean, based on the facts and data, the data and facts are saying one thing, that you have one chance in a million to be killed or to be terrorized by a refugee. That's what the data says, first thing. Mm-hmm. And I have been through the vetting process myself, and I cannot imagine a terrorist waiting for 20 years, 30 years during the process just to come to this country to do harm to others.
You work, Marcia, with people from, as you said, Bhutan, Burma, Somalia, El Salvador, Vietnam, Eritrea, Afghanistan, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Syria, and others. Are there some countries about which you feel more confident in the people coming in than others?
Confident in what way?
In the fact that they are coming here because they need our help and they need a place to live and they're going to be good American citizens versus coming here to do us harm.
No, there's no one group that I feel more or less confident about. Carolina Refugee receives people from all over the world, and all of our clients receive the same level and quality of service no matter what part of the world they come from.
President Trump, during the campaign for the presidency, called the flow of refugees from Syria the great Trojan horse that would bring the people who would perpetrate future terrorist attacks to our shores. I know you think he's wrong, but how can you be sure?
Well, again, I'm working with specific families that arrive to Charlotte. They are coming with their children. They're coming with no language skills. They're themselves taking the chance to be able to be safe and reestablish their lives here. So based on the people that I meet, not on a larger idea of a one particular group, but on actual individuals that arrive in the city, I see what they're looking for, and it's for safety and security in their lives.
And prior to the travel ban, we were on schedule for bringing in about 400 people, if I'm not mistaken, this year. The need is 15 million. Marcia Hirsch is executive director, and Takur Mishra is an immigrant and case manager with the Carolina Refugee Resettlement Agency here in Charlotte. Thank you both for joining us. I appreciate it.